Dr. Nosome Kure and team, welcome to. We know that the DG is represented well by ourselves here today. And all the guests at the back, the back benches, including the CSIR there, our legal gurus and everybody else, welcome. Yeah, let me start off by thanking the committee section and the parliamentary law advisors for the steady work done to bring us to this point, but as well to thank honorable members for your consistent engagement on this piece of legislation. I think we are coming towards the end of this round. And I'm going to start off by opening this bill for general comments first, before we come to the specifics. I also want to assure members that there's some thing that the department wants to also present to us. We'll give them a slot after we've seen how far we're going to just check if there are issues that we must still want to engage here. But I think it's important to also recognize those who are getting old today. Ndate Moagi, happy birthday. I think the birthday boy must stand up so that we must see who we are. Okay, I won't reveal your age. Members, we've got in front of us both the A bill and the B bill. I hope we're reading from the same text columns. The A bill, or the B bill, is the one that you have engaged over time. And I see that there's a member who had an old one. Maybe we should just ensure that you've got the right one. And the A bill is the one that deals with the amendments. Okay? Now, we've got two processes here. The one process is that you can get into this thing, vote, and finish. The other one is the one that recognizes that there are a few problems, cross-referencing problems, and the clause that I want to bring directly to your attention now. Clause 18. Alright, I want to put it on the table so that the legal people who are here and the CSIR and members must assist us to think through this process. Okay? I want to table it for you to look into. But before we come to that specific clause, I'm going to open for political parties, and this is a process for the committee members now to engage and declare support, non-support, or whatever else they see in this bill. If you are the local team, you should tell us, you see, there are things that you see here that we might not have seen. So I'm opening this for about 10 minutes for general comments on this bill. I'm sure you understand. And then my understanding is that some of the amendments that are here are amendments that we more or less agreed upon. Most of them are consequential amendments as a result of the definition of intellectual property and technology, innovation, or whatever. There have been a lot of other technological innovation, other consequential amendments that are coming. So they just seem a lot, but there's basically a lot of stuff. Substantive amendments are very few, and I suggest that we also more or less have an agreement. I didn't sense any major disagreement on this one. But if members want to also disagree, please, you'll be free to do that right here and now. If you don't do it now, you can't go and disagree in the chamber. Members of the ANC, members of the DA, members of AZAPO, welcome to attend, members of all the other parties. If you disagree here, so that we become consistent in the chamber. This story of agreeing what us here and going to the chamber like the ANC affairs does and disagree with everybody else, please, let's be consistent. You see? Yes. All right. Honorable members, the last point that I want to make on clause 18, just to remind you, is that we have agreed that the assets and liabilities will vest with the CSIR. There was an agreement between the department and the CSIR. They made this plea to us. We agreed. And there was also a sum of about 3,000 rand that is outstanding that I think they wanted to give to the AGF. My view, and I'll put it to you, is that we shouldn't separate the assets and liabilities. If we say they belong to the rest of the CSIR, let's do that. They can even have the 3,000. We can't say the patents were the CSIR and 3,000 were the agency. It's not a good law making. The Clause 18 does not provide for that. It's, if you look into Clause 18, 1A and D, you'll come back to that. You'll see that all these will have to vest with it. To be transferred to the agency. 4A, yeah. And the agency here means TIA. The one that we are here with. So I want us to come back to that. Having said all these things, I'm opening this for general comments. Mr. Blasio?
I read something on page 4, which I'm not sure whether that is just rule 1. Page 4, clause 5, subclause 7b. It reads, such a body must be appointed for a period not exceeding 6 months of legal renewal of the charges in terms of subsection 3. Now, if you go back into subsection 3, it doesn't really to what you're saying, then I think it's, you wanted to refer all maybe to subsection 5. Am I wrong in assuming that or not?
The B-ball.
Yeah.
Is it not already on page 5 and you're reading line 37?
Line 36. That's all.
Okay. Okay, I'll come back to you, sir. Let me just, it's general comments, we'll come back to you. What he's referring to is the board of the agency, which is clause 5 on page 4. Just to say that 7b does not refer to, it refers to 3, clause subsection 3, and it doesn't have a corresponding meaning, and so on. I'll note that point so that we come back to it. Mr. Ansley.
Chair, I thought the process we had agreed upon by our silence was that first of all, you would take general overview kind of comments and then you would go into the specific kind of concerns such as those raised by Mr. Longchair.
Point made, but let's be flexible as well if needs be. If the general comments, let's make them. If there's something that is burning that you want to refer to, we won't shoot it down now. We'll just notice them, but still come back to it. Mr. Slam.
But coming back again, Chairperson, to the issue of subsection 7d, read with subsection 3, I do not know how that comes about because they're going to be just the same thing. Subsection 7d refers to the interim structure that shall have been established as a result of the dissolution of the board. That substructure must just be there for a period of 6 months within which the minister must appoint the board or the processes as of 1986 somewhere must have taken place for the new board to have been appointed. And subsection 3 talks about an investment policy framework.
Yes.
Which is something completely different.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Anything else, Demos?
Just to give some clarity, I'm trying to reconcile the issues that arose at the last meeting, and it relates to the hybrid model that we were going to consider. Now, is that something that we must legislate for, or are we just making an assumption that somewhere along the line the department is now going to have to negotiate that? I assume it's going to be some long-term process. process, but it was a clear recommendation that, you know, if this thing is going to operate effectively, that we need to get that clause or that type of arrangement financially secured so that it can be swift in its decision making in such processes. So I just want to maybe just raise that as an issue. I don't say that, you know, one would maybe then consider that part of the regulations or something like that. That there would be a process which would have to, you know, the department would have to pursue. So that was just something that I had in mind. The second one really relates to getting final clarity on the whole issue of the bill which we intend deleting by virtue of this bill. And that is the which clause I'm just trying to the repeal of the law on 17, and whether in there, you know, we need to just safeguard ourselves in respect of any of those liabilities or assets, just in case somewhere along the line there is something that is in the pipeline or is being there that might only be due for payment in 2 years' time, which might have been missed or something like that. I think it would be, you know, it would be a difficult one to, you know, to try and determine based on the fact that we have had a submission from CSIR in respect of the income statement. But, you know, I don't know what assurance we can get other than to say that, you know, if this thing is repealed, somewhere along the line there's some patents or royalties that might still be coming into that agency, that what happens to it, you know, it creates a sense of flux as far as I can see, is where does it go, what happens, etc. We just need to make sure that, you know, that repeal or the repeal that we are proposing covers any other pipeline issues that might still be there that we're not aware of, or certainly CSI might not be aware of and taking over that situation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Farrell. I'm not going to try to respond to everything, but let me just make the following points. On the last point that you made, Mr. Farrell, that talks in Clause 17, that talks about the repeal, we should just bear that in mind, what we're trying to do with the transitional arrangements, Clause 18, in terms of taking your concerns into account as to what should go there. In other words, you must be explicit in Clause 18 as to what happens to what, you know, those patents, the royalties and so on, because as I understand it, now they vest with the CSIR as we speak. And then the other one about the PFMA, which is basically clause 2, subsection 2, the hybrid model. My advice, the department will have to come back to respond to us on this one. But just make a note of that. Is that they have been engaged with Treasury. We don't have to legislate for specifics, whether it's a 3A schedule, 3A or B. We leave that to that negotiations. All we are saying, which suffices in law, is that the agency will comply with the PFMA, whatever way that they will have concluded. But I want the department to come back to us on this one specifically. Anything else? Do I send support on this one? Are we comfortable that we should recommend to Parliament to pass this law after doing the litigations?
I just want to make a general comment with regard to this bill. I think if you look at the amendments and if you look at the bill itself, the numbering is a problem. So I need to clear that up from the department side. And in terms of the funding agency, that is the clause 14 and 18, needs to look closely to each other so that we can make sure that they tally in terms of how we recommend the assets, the rights of assets and liabilities and obligations. And perhaps if the department could sharpen those two clauses with regard to this issue that we'll be talking about, that might be something that we would be, we would welcome actually. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hensley.
Generally, Chairperson, I think we do support the bill very much so, except for the dotting of the T's and the crossing of the I's, was it the other way around? But that will come to. And I think the department has sat in our hearings, I think they've listened to people, that becomes clear in the definition section, We had long discussions and debates about the definitions. Those are there, plain English, straightforward. The department has listened to the stakeholders. And that is a apparent example in 14.2, where initially membership of a board was mandatory. Now a may has been put in there, which leads for discussion as to whether that is in fact an option, whether membership of the agency should become members of the board or not. I think that in itself goes a very long way to meeting the concerns of many of the stakeholders who gave information to us. So generally, and except the nitty-gritties, and maybe except for clause 18, I believe that this bill after week's discussion is a true reflection of what we want and what our stakeholders have presented to us.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Is that the feeling of the membership as a whole?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Now, let me invite the CSIR just for 1 minute. Having looked into clause 18 and the concerns that you've raised, you can just come nearer to the mic, sir. And the concerns that you've raised, sorry for not telling you in advance to that I'm going to launch you. What's your take on 18? So just respond to that concern that you raised.
Chair, firstly, the bill as it worded now confirms the position that as the TA is established, the Invention Development Corporation Bill becomes disestablished in the 3,000 assets at that stage could be transferred, as you suggest. Maybe one should say clearly all assets and all liabilities transferred to CSR. In relation to Mr. Blanchett's concern that, I think it was Mr. Blanchett, that raised the concern that there are these pipeline concerns. I don't share that concern. We've had an audit that those institutions are audited every single year. We are clear, we know what we've got in terms of liabilities and assets. However, if you transfer, if the wording says all assets and liabilities are transferred to CSR, if there are any pipeline issues, CSR will pick those up. So the wording as it stands at this moment, or as varied by yourself, I think would adequately deal with the issues.
Thank you very much, sir. The parliamentary law advisors, are you able to assist us just to make to capture the asset liabilities being transferred to the CSIR?
I think
we're
I think the way the legal advisors have captured it in the legal is sufficient just to change from the TIA to the CSIR. A person may not be appointed or continue as a member of the board if such person is elected as a member of parliament, and then down the line it says appointed as a permanent delegate to the SDP. That's the repetition. You either say as a member of the National Assembly and then also say as a member of the SDP, or just say member of parliament and indeed the SDP. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. You see, I've got a young boy, you see, and at the crash. And if he does anything good, they say, clever boy, you see. So when I do anything good, he says to me, clever boy. And even to mommy, he says, clever boy, mommy, clever boy. So, clever boy. No, Parliament means both two houses.
No.
Okay.
No, that I understand. That is the second part.
Okay, the first part?
The first part that you raised, I might have misunderstood it. But in fact, we have to be saying that the bill is correctly worded as is.
Can you just go back to you?
Currently in the B Bill, it reads that in the commencement of this Act, all the rights, assets, obligations, and liabilities of the corporation vest in the agency. And my proposal is that we change the agency to CSIR. So it will read all rights, assets, obligations, and liabilities of the corporation vest in the CSIR.
Thank you very much. You may speak, Minister.
Thank you, Chair. Just on this proposed amendment and the suggestion that clause 6C would be of tautology or unnecessary, I'm not sure, before we rush into that, I'm not sure that that's correct. Because one is, it says a person may not be appointed or continue if such person is. Under C, it says, elected as a member of parliament, and then it goes on to say, or is appointed as a permanent delegate, and they're two different things.
Okay.
A member of parliament is a member of the National Assembly and a member of the NCOP. Parliament, member of parliament covers both houses. Therefore, there's no need to repeat. A permanent delegate to the NCOP. A permanent delegate to the NCOP is a member of the NCOP. Therefore, if you want to retain a permanent delegate to the NCOP, you then have to change parliament to make it a National Assembly. Because parliament is made up of two houses, the National Assembly and the NCOP. Parliament is not just the National Assembly.
I'm sorry, just to respond to the labor, but there are two, I know, elected as a member of parliament means the two houses.
Yes.
Separate point, or is appointed as a, which is not elected member of parliament.
Then change parliament to National Assembly.
No, I'm sorry. When you say C, it says elected as a member of parliament, that means either as an elected member to the National Assembly or the NCOP, that's understood. It is a separate process where people are appointed by provincial legislatures to parliament. To the NCOP. That is quite different from being elected to the National Assembly or to the NCOP.
Can I come in? Let's do this. Because we don't have to keep spoken hours now.
Yeah, yeah.
We might just want to reflect, okay? My understanding is that if you are a member of the provincial legislature, you are already disqualified. To be on in terms of this, you see, and to be a permanent delegate, you have to come from the provincial legislature. So let us go back and reflect, you see, and then we'll come with a corrected one. All right, but you see, they didn't just say skip scope, they said something else that I'm not at liberty to say here. But yeah, the point is made. Baba.
The other point to be made here is that when you are appointed from a body that disqualifies you, you come having been disqualified already. That is just to make the matter more explicit. Because you, in terms of this clause, you are disqualified where you are, even before you are appointed to come to another place. So automatically, as far as I can see, the point stands because it is neither here nor there. Here. Now, the other matter which can be argued is whether once appointed, let's say you were not disqualified, that's all. It's just for argument's sake. Is whether once appointed, when you enter the NCOP, you become a member of the other parliament. The other parliament, again, you get disqualified from the mention.
So you disqualified twice, in fact,
that's
from
it.
The beginning.
Yeah.
All right. No, that's fine. I think the point is clear, Mr. Harrow.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to raise the issue, which was also in the minutes relating to the clarity in regard to the Chief Executive Officer. As to whether he is in fact an ex officio member of the board, and if so, maybe they can just sort of clarify the department to know why, imagine, just from a point of view of being able to participate in the deliberations of that board, that he would at least have a say as a board, as opposed to just a reporting authority. The ex officio, as I understand it, does not have voting rights on any board. And we just wanted to give clarity, and maybe, you know, we can get that up front, because I see it wasn't a member, so I do. They prefer that to stay, and maybe they can then just justify it.
No, they will, but let's also state our preferences. What, I'm not putting you on the spot, I'm just checking what would be your preference in this one. If I may...
I can just relate to the experience I've had with transport boards. The CEOs of all the various, you know, state operations within the Department of Transport have actually arrived on that board as a member, so it's the board plus the CEO. And the logistics, you know, or the logics behind it seem to stem from the fact that it's at least the role in terms of finances can be more sort of spelled out and they can vote on that. But more importantly is that, and I see that was the argument I was trying to put forward, is that if anybody should be ex officio here, should be a member of the department in their role as either the DG or his or her nominee. In order to be the go-between between the department and also the TIA. So that was my motivation when I raised this question, and that's the experience that I've seen on many of the other boards, like the Road Accident Fund, CAA, etc., etc.
The department might want to respond on that one as well. Let me also state my own experience. My understanding is that you leave the CEO as, not a director, not a board member. He's a functionary of the board. It makes for good corporate governance. We've had situations, can I remind you of the one which was on the papers? The CEO of the post office. Because he was a director and the CEO, having all the knowledge, information, insight, influence, there was chaos at the end, and a lot of other things that you might have read upon on the papers. So to me, for corporate governance, it's much neater if you've got a CEO who's servicing as a functionary of the board, rather than having fiduciary responsibilities. You need those responsibilities with the board that is elected. That's what is appointed. That will be my take on it. And also to discourage the department having somebody there. You see, you can't operate like that. You must either be appointed as a director, you see, and you not represent the department, you take responsibility, you see, and reporting fully in terms of the PFMA, what needs to be reported. But you can't have a department having somebody sitting there. So I don't think one day will have the capacity to also make for good corporate governance. But I'm just raising this other thing as well.
One of the biggest problems is, you know, holding those particular boards to account. The department is the overall responsible, as I see it, department that is going to be overseeing the work of the agency. But also will be directly involved in disseminating policy to that board. It will also be responsible to ensure that the budgetary requirements on the agency is fully met and motivated. It's not going to be the CEO of this agency that will be sitting down with the Finance Committee and Treasury there. It's got to be a government official, a state representative. Now, we don't have anybody here to be the eyes and ears of that. And I mean, the Deputy Minister here, he might maybe even give me more clarity on this, but from all accounts, if that sort of relationship doesn't exist, what we have found, and if I can just put the experience forward here, is that you usually end up with an annual report presented, of which the chairperson is, you know, brought to account at this committee level for any reporting function. And the department here is sometimes not aware of what decisions or what is going on. Now, when you question that thing from an oversight point of view, they say, well, we're not sitting on the board, we don't know what decisions are being made. So clearly there has got to be a relationship between the department and this agency to ensure that the policies, the financing, and those activities which are going to be require negotiation and representation at various levels of government and treasury have got to be on here. And I see this as a void in this particular, you know, the structure of the board. Now, whether that affects what you say, you know, in respect of governance, what I'm saying is, and what I have experienced, is that you don't put that person on as a board member per se. He's there in an ex officio capacity. So he's got no voting rights, but he's able to guide the board where, you know, they feel that they might be going that way or not going that way. That's the one issue. Now, the reason for me wanting to have a certain amount of, you know, explanation, that's all I'm asking for, and I think that's what we, you know, I'm trying to work out there wasn't enough people that have knowledge of Latin, what ex officio actually means. My understanding is that it means that they are there in a capacity that does not allow them to vote or to participate in decision-making processes. So you are in fact separating those powers of the board, so they can be held accountable for the decisions you make. But there's nothing to stop him there, whether he was a director or ex officio, having inside knowledge to, you know, what you were trying to refer to in the post office sort of debacle. So I think that just needs some clarity, needs a bit of thought. I don't know, you know, I mean, if the minister and the deputy minister is happy with that arrangement, so be it. But, you know, I'm just trying to say that, you know, from my own dealings in these boards in transport, which might be a different approach by the minister there, that's what they're, you know, they're
asking for them. All right. Let me take this to the chairman, Mr. Sinal, and then we, on this point.
Thank you very much, Chair. Just to a point, let us not forget that we are saying in the bill that this very agency itself will, among other things, be subject to the TFMA. And I think the TFMA itself is very rigorous in terms of, you know, demanding that entities that are listed, whether it's Schedule 2 or 3 or whatever, that they fulfill certain requirements. But the other point is that, as far as I'm aware, and I just want to recall what the Minister said during the 2007 the debate on the vote of the departments, that they are looking also at ensuring that centers of excellence or whatever, all those kinds of entities, as those that receive advice from the department, that they are not just allowed to go on and spend the money without really accounting for that money in a proper manner. And I think Dr. Mfumakulu or even Dr. Market could perhaps shed some light on that one, because I think there is some mechanism that is used, of course, to complement whatever other processes that are already in place.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sinal.
There are just 3 points there.
3 points, Chairperson, about the issue of the board versus public service. That we must be able to separate between resources and accounts. A resourceful person who comes in to give information of what is on account should not necessarily be part of the puzzle of you. As and when you require that person to give that information, you can make arrangements for the meeting and get that information and thereafter. That's the relationship. And an accounting officer is someone who must take responsibility of the development financially, physically, and otherwise that are happening within that particular institution. Now, when we talk about a CEO, we talk about an accounting officer, somebody who will be accounting for the development that will be going on there. Well, and that person is not necessarily a member of the board. It's a functionary of the board, as you rightly said. But that person is not necessarily having to become a public servant in the form of public servant. It doesn't have to be a director appointed as a director or something who comes here to represent the department inside the board. Because the danger there And I know the situation in transport, I've been there myself, I was a shepherd in the body. The danger there is that the independence and the decision making outside of influence from both political and government on the issues placed before you within the guidelines of the statutes that mandate you gets interfered with if you allow that kind of situation. For the entire period of the term that I was in this situation, it was a big fight between me and the department over that particular issue of administration. Secondly, you lose complete control of your administration for as soon as that administration takes control of the court. The board must be in control of the administration, not vice versa. But lastly, it must be recognized that the issue as to who the board reports to is very clear. The board gets appointed by the minister. And if the board says the minister has the power in terms of the statutes to dissolve it and to appoint another board, following the processes that outlined in the act. So the issue that the board is not accountable by virtue of the fact that the public service is not part of it, it's a non-starter.
Can I just clarify? I'm not talking about the state representative being part of the board in official capacity. I'm referring to, and if I'm correct in this terminology, an ex officio, which means that he doesn't have any rights of decision making. He's purely the ministers or the departments' eyes and ears in respect of having to ensure that there's a dissemination or keeping on track in regard to policy or, for that matter, to take back requests for additional funding or whatever the case may be. Because they are not in a position to negotiate that, as I understand. So I just wanted to get clarity. I don't expect that, as you explained it, and I think that is why there was such a big amount of amendments to the various, you know, transport acts as a result of that, was to keep them as ex officio.
I've noted two more hands. You know, I like this debate. It's a very interesting one. Can I just say two things before I take Mr. Lofolo Fodra, Mr. Ted, and Mr. Kuri Farid? One, this, just the obvious, the duties of the CEO are spelled out in terms of the act. Two, this agency in terms of funding, the money will be appropriated by Parliament. Okay? And the PFMA rules apply. So the board is an independent board that runs the agency that reports here. Alright? I just wanted to make this two points, and I'll leave it at that.
Another point, Chair, is that you see, ex-officials are there sometimes for the reasons that capacitate meetings of boards, sometimes. But you see, in this instance, if you want an ex-officio merely because he comes from his family, it doesn't make sense. That's merely for that reason. But if you want an ex-officio to say that you will need certain information you don't have, it also doesn't make sense because you can get that information by requesting that someone who has that information from that very department would like to have a 10-minute discussion with you at our next board meeting, and the information is given and the person goes out of the meeting. Doesn't need to be sitting there and deliberating with an independent board. So, if indeed we want an ex-officio from the department, we've got to know for what reason. It's just for the sake of just having a person in our meeting, or there is something that we can't do without. And in this case, I can't see anything that the board would need which it can't get through requesting for such information or requesting people to be for some small period at the board meeting to give that information, so that the board can remain in terms of the rules, an independent board which makes its decision independent of any influence. So I still feel that there is no need for anybody from this department to be an ex officio. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chairperson, I think the correct term here is the shareholders' context that the department uses in order to hold these entities accountable, in terms of which or whereby there are certain requirements that they will have to fulfill. So the concern that Honorable Faro raises, in my view, then is sufficiently covered by such a mechanism, which mechanism obviously requires both parties to perform in terms of the agreement that they've reached, that the following things will be done in order for corporate governance to occur or obtain and so forth. So I wouldn't say that you need necessarily have got to have somebody with that ex officio status, which I think loosely translated means by virtue of office. He's talked about the meaning of that in Latin. So, but I think the point that I've raised sufficiently in my view covers the need.
Thank you very much. Ms. Mohamed, I'll come back to you.
Thank you, Colin. I actually don't want to continue on the board, the debate on the board, but I want to actually make one specific comment on phrase 2 on and number 2. Perhaps if we could rephrase it a bit, I was thinking. I read it in this way. If the chairperson is not present at the meeting of the board, the members of the board present at that meeting must elect a member from amongst themselves to preside at such a meeting. It's just a matter of rephrasing, just to make it more clear. Clause 10, number 2.
Are you suggesting that doesn't make grammatical...
Well, I'm just saying it's better probably just to rephrase the bit.
Okay.
If they would consider that. It doesn't really change any meaning of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, just to must elect.
Okay.
Sure. I think they've made a note of that. Mm-hmm.
Tell us.
I was still on that CEO method.
Yes.
Just to wrap it up. The content of Honorable Farrell covers on clause 11, 4. The CEO is accountable to the board. Therefore, the CEO cannot be a colleague.
Let's take the legal gurus behind us, because that won't be any money.
Thanks for getting. I just wanted to exactly to say what was said by the previous speaker. The CEO is not the member of the board only by virtual profit, but he is a functionary who is looking after the interest of the management of the agent. And also, if I can interpret the meaning of text of history, it says the understanding of the honorable member was he doesn't have the voting rights. And that is not necessarily simply the case. They do have voting rights, unless you specify in a legislation that they do not have voting rights. The text of officio, the interpretation of that in the transport laws, the bill that he's talking about, I advise them that if you say as okay, that doesn't necessarily mean they do not have voting, they do have voting. And then the city is not as
thank you very much. Thank you very much. Let us just summarize what we've done so far. We've looked into these amendments, additional amendments, some of them being consequential, which are captured on the ego, okay? Having looked into this, we have noted that the numbering is a problem. So we asked the committee section and the legal section just to do the numbering correctly and the cross-referencing. For instance, the point that was raised on page 4, just to give an example, about reference to subsection 3, it doesn't tally. So if we can just look into what the intention was and then correct that. All right? We want to tighten clauses 17 and 18. Just that if we repeal assets and liabilities and things like those, and I think the point that we're making clearly is that that rests with the CSIR. The problem has just captured that one. We are comfortable with the question of the PFMA. If you look into this on the page 3, that the agency will comply. I mean, the PFMA applies to the agency. The negotiations that were happening between the Department, Treasury, and whoever else about the model is not a matter that we are going to legislate. We are going to just leave that it complies with us. So that is the one thing that we also say. The question relating to the board of the agency and the question relating to the CEO, I think it's sufficiently clarified, but the department still has to just make us comfortable on that one, including on the one of the hybrid, how far you are. I think it's important just to come back to do it before we close the meeting. Members have raised a matter on the disqualification on clause 6 to say that we must just make it appropriate in the way that that obviates the need for necessity for repetition. On page 5, that's clause 10, subsection 2. To read again, and if it's okay, we'll come back to it. If it's got to be tightened in line with what Madam Muhammad Kombe Farida is saying, let's do that. All right? Because I've already dealt with clause 17 and 18. All right? Members have agreed that most of the crucial matters that were raised in the public hearings are covered in the amendment. That's my understanding. And the question about the relationship between the board and the department or the minister is a matter that I think we're trying to clarify debate here. So I want to suggest that it's enough. Okay, let me just take those who are still in doubt. Let me take the suggestion first.
Mr. Chairman, you haven't covered my question or the issue you asked me on page 4, line 37, whether that should be subsection 3 or subsection 5.
Everybody here is witness to the fact that I did. I said, let's correct the cross reference.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Okay, it's okay. You see, I've got many witnesses here. Okay. Yes. If there's nothing else, Mr. Blasio?
No.
Yes, okay. Baba, another call.
Chairman, you're right that probably the matter of the board has probably been adequately debated, but I don't think it's been satisfactorily concluded. We're not too sure what the conclusion is. If the conclusion is that the department must take stock of some of the points made here and come back with some proposal, then I think we can deal with that. The matter of, I think the legal officer has clarified the status of an ex officio member of the CEO, being an ex officio member, therefore being a full voting member of the board, and that is absolutely correct. The question, though, if I heard the discussion here, some comrades seem to feel that the CEO accounting to the board cannot be a member of the board, ex officio or not. And so I'm not sure what the conclusion is of this committee. The general reference point for boards of this nature has been the King Report on governance and some of the proposals on corporate governance.
where, for example, the CSIR, the president of the CSIR is a member of the board, similarly the HSRC, and so forth. So that is a fairly standard model, where CEOs of entities are simultaneously members of the board and accountable to the board. But without reopening the debate, Comrade Chair, I think what would be useful is we can just get a sense of what the conclusion is of this committee. Is this committee saying that we've made various points? Let's refer it back to the department to take stock of these points and come back to the new proposal.
The law as it stands on Board of Agency Clause 5,
yes.
It says under 1B, 1C, the chief executive officer of the agency as an ex-official member. So that's where it stands. That's where we're going to leave it.
The committee is happy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
With or without voting? That's not what you want. So, if it's, yeah, but you have to specify that, because you see, the terminology is what I'm arguing over. That says that, as translated very ably by my colleague, has nothing to do with the issue. What I'm asking there is that do we or do we not have to specify that or not? And if we wanted to have voting rights, then so.
No. Let's do this. You see, members, as it stands, it says ex-official. All right? If you want to make an amendment that says ex-official with no voting rights, then I think we should make that amendment. You see? And if, in the absence of no such amendment, we can't debate it. You see? So I want to just take a step back, Mr. Farrell, and just think it through and maybe bring a proposal. As it stands, we can't devote discuss the voting or non-voting status of.
Actually, I'm quite happy with it. I just want to make sure that you know that it's what the department wants that person to do in terms of holding. You know, at the end of the day, the accountability of this agency. And if the other question, which I put, whether we need to include anybody from the department as part of this process. Now, the Deputy Minister has indicated they'll go back and have a look at what the best model would be, because this is nothing new. I mean, there's boards being formulated all over. Some have worked, some haven't worked. The question is, what does the department want here? Because, really, it's a technical issue, but at the end of the day, we're happy to support that process to make sure that when they do report here, they're accountable, and everybody else can be happy that there's not going to be any, you know, circumvention of the King Commission's recommendations.
I'm going to take the last two hands, last three hands, but I'm just uncomfortable into going to circles. I want to give around circles. I want to give the department to just give us what they prepared for us here in the next 5 to 10 minutes, so that we can try and see if there's anything outstanding. But with this one, I think you've made your point. What I'm suggesting is that if you are in doubt, come back again, you see. But as it stands, I think there is insufficient, as I'm looking for you to say, let's leave it where it stands, you see. And also we must make this distinction. The department is also here to hear what we want, you see. So that we must give them some instruction to say this is how we must do it. Not the other way around. That they must tell us, and then we just become ourselves. I refuse from this chair. Okay? All right. Let me take Mr. Nopolo Bodre, Mr. Detailer, and Ms. Nopolo.
Yes, well, I wanted to also raise the point you have just raised, if you last me, that we are the lawmakers. We don't make laws by asking what you want. We are making laws for our country, so we must know exactly what we want, because we are accountable when the laws are discussed by the public. So there is no question of saying, and we want to know what the department is trying to know. It is us who must make the law, then that's it. But the second point that I wanted to make is that, as it stands, as I understand the legal mind, is that, as it stands, if you say ex officio, it means automatically it is taken that they have voting rights. Only when you want to discriminate
on voting rights, you then say we must. So you only debate it when you have taken a decision that that person who is there, we want to withdraw that which the person is entitled. So as it says, it is what it is. And that I don't have any problem as far as I'm concerned. So that is the understanding. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Well, Chair, I couldn't agree more with Mr. Nkolobode. I know that for Mr. Farrell, it might be a matter of business unusual funds and proceedings.
I'll come back to you. Ms. Moment.
So I want to actually respond also to Mr. Farrell's comment. I think we have a clear definition from our legal advisors of ex officio who has good voting rights. Now, it would not be possible for us to vote without voting rights. So my suggestion would be then to put the ex officio definition in our definition list to ensure that we can, we cannot put on the voting rights. Because the definition itself is
self-explanatory.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. If you look at the minutes, I was responding to the minutes to ask the department to come back and tell us what they meant about that. And if they're satisfied that I'm happy, let's move ahead. But I'm not arguing and trying to determine that the department should tell us what law to make here. I wanted clarity, and now I think I've been satisfied with the clarity to the extent that. It is now completed, except in the part we said there, what capacity would the DST would like to know whether they require, or how what representation would they have on the board in terms of trying to keep accountability of that board, or even whatever capacity.
I think at this point, members, I promised the department to give them a few minutes just to throw in their assistance as well. I think we are sufficiently satisfied that we have a bill that we can defend, all of us, with those changes and amendments. Dr. Nkolobode?
Thank you, Chair. We've addressed most of the issues, Chair. We will not be giving a presentation, because the presentation was to answer. And some of the questions that came through from the previous meeting. But I think it's important that we clarify the issue of the department representation on the TIA board. We spent, a lot of time discussing this issue in preparation for this meeting within the department. And I just want to share with the members the experience that we've had in the instruments that we're going to be holding in within TIA. The members will know that the Biotechnology Regional Innovation Center will be folded into TIA, and the department is represented as observers in those boards. The experience we've had is that if the board is not forming it, or if there are allegations of mismanagement, then come to the department. The board then says to the department that, well, so and so was at that meeting when we made that decision. When the decision was taken, your representative was there. But that representative had no power to stop the board from making a decision. And so that the independence of the board is very important, and we're taking that from the lessons that we've had in managing the instruments that we've been holding into TIA. So the position that we arrived at, that we're presenting for consideration by the honourable members, is a position that comes from experience that we've had in managing these instruments. We then use mechanisms like quarterly reports. And in the Biotechnology Innovation Centers, we have meetings, monthly meetings with the chairpersons of the board. And before they have a board meeting, I meet with the chairpersons of the board to discuss issues that they might want clarity on from the department. And we then use the business plan and annual report as measures of control as well. And one of the members indicated that we use our shareholder contact with the instruments. At the moment, with the bridge, we have the MOAs, and we use those to try and manage them. And our experience has shown that with those measures in place, and if the department is paying attention to the quarterly report, that's enough to keep the department informed about what's happening in the organization.
You see, in your presentation that you haven't given to us, your understanding of ex officio is without a non-voting delegate. Okay, all right. So
it's clarified by the state law advisement, and we will accept that position.
Good. I don't think we have to sit here if we don't have to discuss serious parliamentary business. Unless you want us to have a birthday bash, then we can stay longer. Now, we are going to clean up this bill as soon as it's ready. At our first, we have to come to a. What is it?
What is it? What do we do?
Members, just information. This bill goes to Parliament on the 4th of March. Are we together, Mr. Lopolofodo and Mr. Ted? This bill goes to Parliament for adoption or approval and endorsement on the 4th of March. So between now and next Tuesday, we are going to get a cleaned up bill that we are voting upon clause by clause or section by section or paragraph by paragraph, page by page, line by line, section by section, whatever, next Tuesday. Okay? So we need a quorum next Tuesday to adopt this bill. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you have any copies for me?
No, I made copies of the presentation. I'll send you an electronic
copy. Oh, you have copies? I'll
send you an electronic copy. Only when you can't make copies.
Okay.
That's the only time
I'll make copies within the
past few months.
That's fine.
So if you have to wash your hands, what is there that you do?
I'm going to go to the next one.